So these are the opening words of Srimad Bhagavatam, where Lord Krishna is established as Vasudev, the son of Vasudev. And then the Bhagavatam continues with the verse Janmadhyas Hiyataha Yatum Vyat Idaratas Chante Swabhikya Swarat, and so on. And it basically described that Krishna is the Janma of everything, or he is the origin of everything, or the birth of everything. And today we're discussing the birth of the birth of the one who is the birth of everything. That is the... And Bhagavatam gets into it. Kunti Devi is speaking, and she's pointing out how is it that the Ajajatam, how is it that the unborn is taking birth? That is her first point. And then she is, in other words, she is getting into the reasons why the Supreme Lord appears, and she starts to answer them, and she starts to say that some are saying because in their previous life Vasudev and Devaki were performing great austerities as Sutapa and Prishni, and that Krishna in response to these austerities appeared. Others will say that the Lord appeared because Bhumi went to Lord Brahma, and then all the demigods, Lord Brahma felt greatly aggrieved to see the sad situation that Bhumi was in. Bhumi had appeared in the form of a cow, and all the demigods, along with Bhumi, they went to the shore of the ocean of milk and prayed to the Supreme Lord, who then sent a message via Lord Brahma and basically instructed that very soon I will appear and all of you should also appear in the family of, in the dynasty of the Yadus. In this way, the stage is set, and Vasudev and Devaki are getting married. Kamsa is driving the chariot very nicely, and everything is very festive, a great celebration, when suddenly this voice from the sky spoils the whole party by announcing, "Oh, Kamsa." And Kamsa had a bit of a temper, you know. There's certain things you couldn't say to Kamsa, and then this voice just said it. "Don't you know?" No, he didn't. "Don't you know that the eighth son of your sister," I mean, cousin's sister, as it goes, "but will be the cause of your death, will kill you." Well, I mean, Kamsa immediately flared up and grabbed the hair of Devaki and was ready to take action effectively by killing her. And then Vasudev is somehow or other trying to reason with Kamsa, because Kamsa was very powerful, very, very powerful. Anyway, for now, I'll make a long story short, and Vasudev and Devaki promised to give each child that was being born to Kamsa, so there was nothing to fear from his sister. So that was going on, and in the beginning, Kamsa thought, "That's great, that's not a problem. I don't have to worry about these children, because the eighth child is the one." But then Narada Muni went there, and Narada Muni, he sort of made some politics. I mean,
Narada Muni went there and started to explain that it just depends how you count, where you start counting. And Kansa was thinking, my God, I never thought of that. And why Narada did that, you know, because it sort of makes him responsible for the whole thing, right? For all these children that were just slaughtered and murdered. And, you know, I mean, a court of law would probably convict Narada, right? And give him a long jail sentence for sure. Now he's eternal, so that part might not worry him too much. But at the same time, though, he took a risk there. By inciting Kamsa to kill innocent children. So why did Narada do that anyway? Isn't he supposed to be a saintly person? And aren't saintly persons as supposed to be benevolent? A question that could be raised. Well, no, Narada, his benevolence was not the short-term benevolence of a materialist. His benevolence was existing on a much deeper level. His benevolence was basically that he was thinking, how can I get the world the greatest blessings? And let's get it on. Let's get the whole show on the road. Let's get on with it, you know. What are we waiting for? So, you know, when all these other children are just like out of the way, and then, you know, then we get ready for the eights a bit sooner. In this way, the Lord will appear sooner and the world will be blessed greatly. So in this way, Narada was thinking, and what's a few children on eternity? It's not a big deal. They all take birth and die anyway. So he was not getting too emotional about the whole thing. He had that sort of eternal perspective. Well, then we see how the Lord appears in jail before Vasudev and Devaki, and, you know, in full size, right, in full attire, jeweled helmet, silken yellow dhoti, and jewels on the chest, and like some whitish hair also there. Then a golden, huh? Four arms, and all these kind of things that one would associate with Lord Vishnu, as we know from the pictures. So here it was quite clear that the Supreme Lord was appearing there, and appropriately so, they offered prayers. Vasudev was a bit more philosophical. Devaki was all heart. After Vasudev glorified the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Devaki also glorified the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then suddenly her intelligence became slightly clouded by emotions because she forgot that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-powerful. And she was thinking that something had to be done, because otherwise Kamsa would certainly come and kill him. So please, please, now hide yourself, please, because otherwise Kamsa will come here and kill you. Now, that's a little inconsistent, philosophically speaking, but she knew he was the Supreme Lord, and she knew the qualities of the Supreme Lord, but emotions are such that one can just forget and just become absorbed in that emotion, and everything else doesn't exist any longer. And in this way, Devaki was asking the Lord to become a child, who obliged, and the child Krishna was there, and then they were actually, Vasudev and Devaki, they were shackled to the wall with chains. So, quite brutal. But somehow or other, these chains opened up. had opened up. It was at midnight that the child appeared, but somehow or other the whole palace was in deep sleep, and yes, then we remember Vasudev was carrying the child to the Yamuna. There was rain, storm, the Yamuna was very high, but there was a jackal that walked across, and when Vasudev saw it, he said, oh, it's not so deep, I can actually also walk across, and so he did, and came into Vrindavan, and there, Yasoda had just given birth at the same time, and he exchanged the children, took the girl from Yasoda and left the child Krishna there. All right, so now I've got the storyline, which we find in Bhagavatam. At the same time, when we are going a little bit, when we read a little broader, then we find that in other literatures, such as Laghu Bhagavatamrita, it is described that Krishna also took birth as the son of Yasoda. And that when Vasudev actually came to Vrindavan, that Yasoda had given birth to twins. And that Vasudev took the boy Krishna that had appeared in Mathura, and that boy Krishna merged with the boy that Krishna that Yasoda had given birth to. And then, now I don't know if Vasudev paid full attention to that fact because he was sort of in a rush. So I guess he kind of missed it. You know, I'm not even sure if he realized she gave birth to twins. Anyway, he was in a rush. He had to get back, put the child down, grab the girl, and before you know it, he was out the door. Meanwhile, the two Krishnas indeed became one, which is quite a feat. But the Supreme Lord is known to do such things, that manifesting different forms that can also merge within him. A book that is shedding some more light on everything, on the cause of all that, how Krishna appears in two places at the same time, is the Garga Samhita. Now, there has been a lot of discussion. Is this book bona fide? Is it not bona fide? But in his Digdarshini Tika, Sanatan Goswami gives a list of books that give more confidential insights about the Supreme Lord, and lists the Garga Samhita. So, we are Bhaktivinoda Thakur, also cited from the Garga Samhita. So, I'll cite also from the Garga Samhita. I think I'm in parampara when I do so. Looks like that. Now, there is an interesting story. Namely, that when the demigods and when they went to the ocean of milk before the Supreme Lord, and that there was a reference about appearing in this world, that there was also another Hare Krishna, Shishi Pancha Tattviki Jaya, that there was also another pastime taking place at the same time. And that was Lord Vishnu, he told them that actually the situation was serious and that they should turn to Krishna to deal with all the problems that were there on earth and so on. And he showed them a pathway to Goloka, which basically was when Vamana had taken his steps and cracked the shell of the universe. At that time, there was a hole made, and we know the Ganga, a drop of the causal ocean came through, and the Ganga came through. Well, Lord Vishnu showed that there was a river there, and the demigods going right through that hole, and the demigods went on the boat to, on that river, and soon enough, they reached. First they saw
the form of the Lord, and they saw how all the incarnations of the Lord were entering into that form. And finally, they came before Krishna, and Krishna told them told the demigods they should all take their birth in the Yadus, and he said he would soon appear, and he also said he would appear in Vrindavan, yes, and that all his associates from Golok, they would also appear. When Krishna said he would appear in Vrindavan, Radharani became quite upset, and so Krishna agreed, no, it's okay, you can come. You can also appear. So she said, no, but how could you go? That's not the point. That's not the point. It's not the point that I will also be. No, the point is that how can you be happy without Govardhan and all these other things that are there in the spiritual world, that big banyan tree and Bandiravan and all the, and the Yamuna and all those things. So, then Krishna agreed, yes, yes, they will also appear. So then Vrindavan Dham appeared, although it is eternal, but anyway, it manifested for the pastimes. And the residents of Vrindavan were also there, and the cowherd boys appeared, the gopis appeared, and it gave opportunity for many personalities, some eternal personalities to come down from the spiritual world, and for some devotees from the material world to enter into the pastimes of Krishna, the Gopakanya, the Devakanya, the Risicharis, the Srutiharis, or the daughters of the cowherd men, the daughters of the demigods, the Vedas personified, and the sages of Dandakaranya, they all had the opportunity now to become gopis in the pastimes of Krishna and be with the Lord personal. There were also Nichasiddha gopis who came from the spiritual world. And all this, in this way, Krishna was doing much more than the Krishna in Vrindavan started to do much more than what the Krishna in Vrindavan did, in Mathura did. The Krishna in Mathura was basically, according to the Brihad Bhagavatam Rita, fulfilling the purpose, paritranaya sadhanam vinasya saduskritam dharma samstarpanatya sambhavami yuge yuge, came to establish principles of religion, to annihilate a few demons on the way, and just a few more demons to kill. Then I'll come back to Vrindavan. Meanwhile, in Vrindavan, Krishna was revealing his most confidential pastimes of the spiritual world. So, since we are here this morning among devotees, I'm sort of bringing in this dual appearance of Krishna. Tonight, in the public program, you won't hear mum is the word. Yeah, I won't say nothing about these things. But now, no. I will not share these confidential things. Oh, definitely not. But this morning, of course, for our own interest, it's just interesting that Vamana made a hole in the universe and that there's a river there and all these things. I mean, my mind likes these stories. It's interesting. And the deeper reason behind it. And how Krishna's pastimes are multifaceted. And how the real cause of his appearance is not to annihilate demons and not to establish principles of dharma, but to just to strengthen the love in the hearts of his devotees, so that his devotees will just, that love will just go beyond control. So yesterday, last night, we did a little Adivas talk, and I took that theme that ultimately the real purpose of Janmashtami is to deepen our relationship with Krishna. And that is also Krishna's real purpose Krishna's real purpose is that somehow or other, this relationship between him and his devotees is becoming deeper, and that the love that is felt by his devotees is just becoming more and more strong and more overwhelming and more out of control. I mean, not like kind of, I love Krishna, I really do. I love him very much. Yeah, that's good. And that's described also when it is described that the Madhyam Adhikari for Ishvara Tadadine Su Bali says that Dvisatcha Prema Maiti Kripu Peksha Yakaruti Samanama. It said the Madhyam Adhikari for Ishvara, he has Prem. I really like that it said he has Prem, because I've heard so many people speak about Prem as something inconceivable, alien, very distant, very remote, that you can never get in a million lifetimes unless you connect to a guru who's a Parama Prista Priya Sakhi. But in that verse of from Bhagavatam, which gives the definition of a Madhyam Adhikari, it is said the Madhyam Adhikari has Prem for the Supreme, for Ishvara, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ishvara Parama Krishna. So Ishvara means Krishna. Supreme Personality of Godhead. We got that. Then that Prem, yes, it is Prem, but it is not of the same intensity as the Prem that is experienced by the residents of Vrindavan. Uddhava certainly had love for Krishna. In Dwarka, who had more love for Krishna than Uddhava? Uddhava was just famous. Uddhava was just incredibly overwhelmed with feeling for Krishna, and he was very intimate with Krishna. Uddhava and Krishna were joking, and Uddhava was so learned, he was the disciple of Brihaspati. Therefore, Uddhava was so learned that he could, by make all kinds of jokes that no one understood. And he had these conversations based on knowledge. It was so subtle. No one figured it out, and only Krishna. So between them, they had their secret exchanges in public, while all the various dignitaries of Dwarka were seated on thrones next to Krishna in the royal assembly hall. Uddhava was having a whole thing going. And then, after it was over, and they were taking Uddhava, they were taking all the after the assembly was over, Krishna would go to his quarters and would be followed by everyone. So as Krishna go, everyone would go, and then, well, after a little while, Krishna was still talking and smiling and giving everyone some attention, and then some announcement was made that now Krishna needed to rest, and that, they should leave him alone. So, that terrible moment had come, but reluctantly everyone left, and then, except Uddhava. Because Uddhava thought it had nothing to do with him. That was for the general people. That had nothing to do with him. You know, so he stayed, and he would massage Krishna's feet, Krishna's lotus feet, while Krishna lied down, and sort of be there, like in those intimate moments. So Uddhava was the most intimate devotee in Dwarka. But then when Krishna finally sent a messenger, and he sent Uddhava to Vrindavan to alleviate the separation of the residents of Vrindavan, then Uddhava realized that he had no love at all. When he saw, and there are so many things that I like, and that, I repeat also, because things you like, you repeat, right? So, but when Uddhava saw some Mother Yasoda, tears were streaming from her eyes, milk was streaming from her breast, and when Uddhava saw all that, he thought, she's going to become a river. This is from the
Gopal Champu. And then, yes, and Nanda Maharaj, he was just beyond himself. The separation that they were experiencing was just extraordinary. Like at one point, Yasoda is just saying, how could to Nanda Maharaj, how could you let him go? How could you let him go? And, to Mathura, that is, right? And when Akrura took him away, how could you let him go? And then Nanda Maharaj said, you mad woman, don't you know that Krishna has just gone to the forest and that soon he'll be back? So it's like that love of Vrindavan is just something extraordinary. So Krishna comes to do both these things. Krishna comes in two forms, and Krishna comes to establish these principles of religion and to annihilate a whole bunch of demons. I mean, 640 million people wiped out in Kurukshetra, an impressive number. Even today, that would be something. So the Kurukshetra war still stands out as a impressive means of alleviating the burden of the earth. But then Krishna established principles of religion. In Dwarka, in chapter 70 of the Krishna book, which is also a chapter I really like, there Krishna's daily activities are described. And it is described how Krishna in the morning begins to see auspicious things. They wake him up with a few, with glorification. And then once he's awake, he begins to immediately watch auspicious things. And as he is, like statues of cows. So how nice in the morning to look at statues of cows. And these things. And so after Krishna has done all that, then even before his bath, he's ready to receive some brahmanas and already give some charity to these brahmanas. And later on, will take his bath, give more charity, and so on. So, the daily activities of Krishna are described, and Krishna at one point is meditating. He's meditating. And he's meditating on himself, because it's pointed out that one has to meditate on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so, what to do? Who can he meditate on? It's like, no other option. He's forced to meditate on himself. Not that we also meditate on himself, on ourselves. That pillar is dangerous. That pillar is your enemy. That pillar is trying to take you away. Could be a demon. Anyway, so Krishna is indeed establishing the principles of Dharma by example. And that he's killing demons, he's quite well known for killing a whole bunch of them in various dramatic ways. So, yes, he is fulfilling that verse, that mission described in the Bhagavad Gita. Dharma samstarpanatiya, and so on. In Vrindavan, Krishna is not, that's not his objective at all, to establish principles of Dharma. In Vrindavan, his objective is to capture the hearts of all the residents of Vrindavan. And he does it again and again in all kinds of playful ways. The most interesting part is that he is so human. It's very nice. that when the four-handed form appeared in Mathura, that he became like a child, helpless and a child, and was then taken to Vrindavan. It is very nice that Krishna is performing these childhood pastimes, clumsy like a child, together with Balaram, grabbing the tails of calves and skiing through the mud are some of the things they were doing, right? On their bellies, lots of fun. Skiing, belly skiing, on the mud. Very human, amazing human things, and then these superhuman things at the same time, which blow everyone's mind. But if he would do only superhuman things, then how can you love him? Like Srila Prabhupada in one lecture is describing the universal form. With the many mouths and with, with the many arms, legs and all these things, and chewing up the heroes on the battlefield of Kurukshetra as if they are potato chips. Right? So that is kind of a dramatic thing. And then and Srila Prabhupada is saying, yes, how can you relate to the universal form? How can we relate to the universal form? Just too large. How can you dress him? Right? You know, I mean, Krishna you can dress, you can get personal, but how can you dress the universal form? It's impossible. It's like a lot of people, they like to have pets. It's a big thing. Krishna also has pets, so that's where it comes from. Radharani has pets, so in this world also, always people have pets, and they get some parrot who is like some squeaky creature making horrible noises, and a smelly cage with a hamster inside, or all these kind of things, right? To have a pet. I mean, I have some frustrations. My sister had a pet, and then a hamster, and she let it out of the cage when she was a kid in the room. And I was in my pajamas, and that hamster went into my pajama pants. And ever since then, I don't like to get too close to hamsters. I survived it. Everything is all right. But it was a scary moment. So, pets. Pets, we like to have our pets in, and what was I going to say with that?
Dressing Krishna.
And now, what? Too great. Thank you. That was it. You're right. That's the point. He focuses my mind. So now we have pets that sort of relate to us in size. Imagine you would choose an ant as a pet. It will be difficult, you know. What if the pet goes outside, there's so many ants, which one is it? Right? I mean, now, you may paint its legs red, you know, so that you, or blue, right? Some bright color, yellow, something, so that you can recognize your pet. That's, so you might get over that hurdle. But then the next one, when you have a pet, one of the big things about a pet is like, you know, sort of coochie-coo and like scratching the pet behind it, petting it, you know, and you pick it up and hold it, you know. You do that with your aunt, next moment two of the legs will break off, right? Or even worse, you know, squashing the back as you're sort of carefully petting, right? It is a problematic relationship. It will be difficult to have an ant as a pet. Now, you might, some academically may argue and say, yes, but, you know, there was a flea circus in Paris. And I grant you that. I grant you that. You know, that that they did have pets and that they trained the fleas and made them jump over little sticks in Paris, and still it exists today, a flea circus in Paris, which tells you something about Paris if you think about it. But leaving all that for what it is, my real point is, it's not so easy when the size is very different to get too intimate. What to speak of tiny human beings and the universal form? I mean, then the difference in size is just like, doesn't even compare between human beings and ant. You know, it's just way, way beyond anything that we can imagine. So, impossible. So what kind of relationship one could have? One could only go on one's knees. On one's knees, one will go, and one will just in fear and in just awe and in great reverence just pray and say, I, insignificant worm, oh my great unlimited Lord, am worshipping you and begging you to kindly be kind to me. Please. Don't crunch me. That's all one could possibly do. How different it is when Krishna appears in his human form. How different it is when Krishna is so accessible. But in Mathura, he is a king. And kings, oh, they have servants and they have bodyguards and they have all these people around them. So even, and in Dwarka, same thing. And then you can't stop, says the guard. No common folk allowed. But Krishna, although he appeared in the royal family, he moved to the common folk, the Vaishyas, and was one with them, an ordinary person, and therefore so accessible. And this is the most amazing thing, where Krishna is just really now awakening that love. You get a close-up? Oh yes, you can see the ripples in his belly, three ripples that make him very beautiful as a child. Then after, as he's growing, little soft hairs begin to grow on the body of Krishna, very beautiful. And so on, he's revealing his beauty as he goes through different stages of youth. What can we say? Oh, in this way, Krishna is not just, sort of, okay, here I am, three bent form, three banga rupa, and I am the all attractive, and Krishna is my name. And you know, Krishna is my name, all attractive is my game. What? Not like that. He is in an intricate way, completely capturing the minds of his devotees. So this is what we're also supposed to do. This is what we. And especially on a day like Janmashtami, this is what we're trying to do. Try to sort of get absorbed. Go a bit beyond our usual level where the books, a lot of people have a full set of books, but when you open them, clouds of dust appear from the pages. Spiders are running away to the corners of the book cupboard. You know, and going, what's going on? You know, we live here. And when we open a book, yes, okay, usually after the first or possibly the second page, our head starts sort of falling forward, and then we think, maybe I should just take a 5-minute nap before I continue reading, so that I can actually stay awake while I'm reading. And then after the 5-minute nap, it's like, oops, that was 1 hour. And then there's no more time to read. We do read lots of messages on our phones. And there you get interesting bits about Krishna. Like today's Janmashtami, and it's going to be full of all kinds of little interesting tidbits and quotes. And so in this way, one can have a phone Janmashtami, but the thing about it, it doesn't, it just stays on the surface. I think it should be renamed to surface book. Something that's not very deep, not very profound. And this is our business, to get, to go deep, to become deeply absorbed. And to, that means in all detail, captured by Krishna, in all detail, captured by his lotus eyes. Have you seen Krishna's lotus eyes? Lotus feet, lotus hand, reddish. And the acharyas, they do that. They zoom in. They zoom in on these details. Like Krishna's Kaviraj writes one short little book, Sukhasari Samhita, where the male parrot and the female parrot have a discussion. And the male parrot glorifies Krishna and is describing how the feet of, lotus feet of Krishna are reddish because they are heralding like the, his rising influence. You begin with the feet. You begin with the feet, and the feet are reddish because that's where it begins. Then the influence of Krishna comes in your life, and the beginning of the day is also reddish. So in this way, as the sun is in the beginning, creates reddish light in the sky, therefore in the beginning, when we begin with Krishna's feet, there is also reddishness, and then we explore the unlimited qualities of Krishna. All right, and then the sari, the female parrot, has a whole different perspective on the thing, and in her, according to her perception, the reddishness on Krishna's feet is showing his embarrassment, and his feet are blushing, right? When you are embarrassed, your face gets red with you start blushing, right? Especially when you're a teenager, that is a big problem, right? In public, you feel embarrassed and you get all red. So the feet of Krishna, the gopi, the sari explained, are getting reddish because Krishna feels embarrassed about his love for the gopis, which he's trying to hide. But he can't hide it, and he's afraid that he is actually getting caught, and therefore his feet are blushing, right? And showed his reddishness. Anyway, so we can see here that that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is getting absorbed in the lotus feet of Krishna and the reddish color at the lotus feet of Krishna, and is meditating on it, thinking about it, writing about it, and just deeply absorbed in thoughts of Krishna. And this is the purpose of Jamashtami. That somehow or other we get deeply absorbed. Therefore, in some temples, they have different things going on at the same time, and there's one room in the temple where the whole day Krishna book is being read. Right? And one can go in that room and sit there for a while, hear a little Krishna book, and just read a little Krishna book, and different people come in and out. And it's a very nice thing, very nice, to just get absorbed. Others are, as I said yesterday, they are just, you can't even talk to them on Jamashtami. Haribol, are you home? Anybody there? And it's like, you know, and they, I know one devotee, he does 128 rounds and 128 Bhagavad Gitas every Jamashtami for like now for
distributes
128 Bhagavad Gitas and chants 128 rounds, and he does it now like at least 35 years every Jamashtami. It's powerful. I mean, yeah, it's like you really.
On the street?
Yeah, on the street, yeah.
Or he gives them away.
No, he distributes it. Well, maybe he sneaks in a few and gives a few away. But no, he actually distributes them on the street, yeah? Yeah?
I'm impressed.
Yeah, I also, 35 years. I mean, what's he going to get for that? That jump, you know? I mean, that that Janmashtami alone, that will really put some weight on the scale. You know, at the end of your life, there's the scale, and it's all like, it's being weighed, you know, like all the nonsense, okay, plenty of that, and then the devotional service. And then in his case, there's like, boom, Janmashtami. That's going to be substantial, right? Substantial. So yes, it is a day to get absorbed, to remember Krishna, to glorify Krishna, to somehow or other spend the whole day with Krishna and to not waste a second. Therefore, we will not even eat. There's no time for eating today. No time. It's like, it's not that you have to fast. It's just no time to eat. There's no time. There's too much to do. Too much. Krishna's qualities are unlimited. Too much to do. No time to eat. No time to sleep. Watch out for the enemies. The pillar. The bed. A comfortable armchair. Oh, soft pillows. The wall. Beware. Beware of these enemies that try to eat away our time from Krishna. Oh no. Oh no. Not today. Today is Sri Krishna Janmashtami. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. That was the cake. Now we get the cream and the cherry.
I think we got already the icing and the cherry. I think, what is our schedule?
This is time.
It's time. No breakfast. I thought he was joking. No.
Want a schedule for real?
No, just, okay. I mean...
You can go as long as you like, isn't it?
No, I'll keep it short. should we stand up for a minute, just to stretch? Yoga, standing yoga. Tadasana.
Could I just sneak out for 2 minutes and do what I have to do and come back?
As long as you like. Does that remind you of anything? Cows. Whose cows? Krishna's cows. All right. This would be an example of what's called, technical term, Uddipana. Uddipana means something that reminds you of Krishna. So today is a special day for remembering Krishna and things related to Krishna, looking for what reminds us of Krishna. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Itinamine Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Nama. He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabando Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishavanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So, after this wonderful presentation of Krishna, Krishna's appearance, what can I say?
Many things.
Well, I will not be so extemporaneous. I'm going to take help from the book, the Bhagavatam. I have here an edition which was of the 10th canto, which was done by our dear godbrother Bhanu Swami with the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So I thought we can look at, we'll start with one verse and we'll see, maybe more than one verse. But we want to get something of the flavor of, Shukadev Goswami, of course, is relating the 10th, in most of the Bhagavatam, and also something of the flavor of the mood, the appreciation that the acharyas, in this case, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has. Let us remember today, as we will be especially remembering tomorrow, that most probably most of us, if not all of us, would have no idea of anything to do with Krishna if it weren't for Srila Prabhupada having brought Krishna to us. And so it's, I think, very nice that we are celebrating. It's a double festival. It's two in one that Srila Prabhupada made by, shall we say, his own arrangement of appearing the day after Janmashtami. But we can already begin today also preparing for the remembrance of Srila Prabhupada tomorrow. We can remember the fact that it is Srila Prabhupada who has brought us at great risk to himself, giving himself to give us Krishna. Well, this is not the mood of Kamsa. Not at all. And so here we have some reference. This is in chapter 2 of Canto 10. I should mention, I think I mentioned a couple of days ago, that the 10th canto is referred to as the laughter of the Lord. So this 10th canto especially, of course, is being prepared for us by all of the 9 cantos, beginning, as we heard, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and then Janmadyasya Yatonvaya Nitaratas Chardeshvavinyasvarat. It all begins with Janma, and we are celebrating today the Janma of the one who is without Janma and who is, as you nicely said, is the source of all Janma. And we have a problem with the Lord's appearance. It's a problem especially for Kamsa. It's a problem for Kamsa in such a way that brings so much joy to the devotees. We are very joyful when we hear how fearful Kamsa was. Why is that? Well, let's read this verse. This is Canto 10, Chapter 2, verse 24. Asina sambishangs tishtan bunjana paryatan mahim chintayano rishikesham apashyat tanmayam jagat. While sitting on his throne or in his sitting room, while lying on his bed, or indeed, while situated anywhere, and while eating, sleeping, or walking, Kamsa saw only his enemy, the Supreme Lord, Rishi Kesha. In other words, by thinking of his all-pervading enemy, Kamsa became unfavorably Krishna conscious. Unfavorably Krishna conscious? Yes, it's possible. And it turns out this is one of the central themes of the whole Bhagavatam, is to make this point that it is possible to become Krishna conscious in any number of ways, and Krishna will reciprocate with how one approaches him. And of course, Krishna tells us that in the Bhagavad Gita, ye yata mang prapadyante tangs tataiva bhajamyaham mama vartmana vartante manushya parta sarvasha. Everyone, he says, is following my path in all respects. I often wondered about that. What does that mean, that everyone is following Krishna's path in all respects? When I think of a path, I usually think of a street going sort of two directions. You can go one way or you can go the opposite way, unless it's a one-way street. But everyone is following Krishna's path. What does that mean? And then I found an explanation of this by His Holiness Radhanath Swami. After many, many years of wondering, how is this? Then he explains very nicely. Everyone follows Krishna's path in the sense that everyone is in orbit around Krishna. Just like there's the sun and there's the planets and they're all orbiting around Krishna and they're each following a path of their orbit. Everyone follows my path, while Krishna's path is circling Krishna. Everyone is connected. Some are closer to Krishna, and some are further away from Krishna. Pluto, you've heard of Pluto? Planet Pluto? I think they officially decided sometime a couple of years ago that it's actually not a planet. It's too far away or something. I don't know. or then the opposite, the closest planet, what is it, Mercury or Venus, one of those two. And then the Earth is somewhere in between. It's a little further away from Mercury and Venus, at least according to the Western system. But the point is that we're all circling around Krishna. Where are we in this circle? How far away are we from Krishna? Well, Kamsa was quite close. But how was he close? He was close in such a way that he could not stop thinking of Krishna. He was seeing Krishna everywhere, in everything. Wherever he looked, in his dream, in his walking, his sitting, his eating, he was only thinking of Krishna. And why? Because he was afraid. He was afraid of Krishna. So, this absorption in Krishna is a theme of the Bhagavatam. But of course, we understand we don't want to be like Kamsa. Most people in the world are not like Kamsa. Most people in the world have a bigger problem than Kamsa. What? A bigger problem than Kamsa? Yes, they have a bigger problem, and the bigger problem is that they are indifferent. So they may be in orbit, but they're way out. They're way out in the distance. They cannot even perceive the light and the heat of Krishna. And so they're in a problematic position. So the Bhagavatam is preparing us for the 10th canto with the first 9 cantos. I like to tell this story, true story, about a professor, one of our senior, retired now, professors in Oxford, who was gifted a set of Bhagavatams for his help that he gave to our Oxford University project. And he's a very, very nice person, and he is a very religious person from the Christian tradition. And some weeks after he received the Bhagavatam, he came to our center and he said, "You know, I was reading in First Canto. It was very interesting. I was reading in one of the purports where it says that one should read systematically the first 9 cantos before reading the 10th canto. And so, and it warns you, one should not, definitely one should not jump over the first 9 cantos to the 10th canto." He said, "Well, as soon as I read that, I couldn't resist. I jumped right to the 10th canto." In the 3rd canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have the 4 Kumaras. They are approaching Vaikuntha. They're going through the gates of Vaikuntha. There are 6 gates that they proceed through, one after another, without obstruction. And then they come to the seventh, the final gate, the inner gate. And there they meet obstruction. And the obstruction is Jai and Vijay. And they say, who are you? Who do you think you are? What do you think you are doing here? You don't know what is the dress code of Vaikuntha. Because they were naked. And so there was some altercation. Altercation means some argument. Eventually Lord Vishnu comes. And when Lord Vishnu comes, something interesting happens. Of course, he sort of resolves the whole situation in terms of who is getting cursed. The demons, Jai and Vijay, indeed were cursed to go to the material world for three lifetimes and so on. But what's really taking place there, you could say, the crucial moment is when the four Kumaras smell the tulsi leaves which are attached to the feet of Lord Vishnu. That's when something special happens. What is it that happens? They become transformed. They become initiated, actually. This is their initiation. In essence, they enter into Vaikuntha having met the personal Lord. They realize what they couldn't understand without meeting the Lord is that the Lord is a person. And the Lord's form is so beautiful. And he has such features as feet. And these feet are very beautiful. And on these feet, there are these tulsi leaves. And these tulsi leaves, they have this nice aroma. And it's described that this aroma entered into their through their nostrils. So as they're attempting to enter into Vaikuntha, Vishnu, in the form of the aroma of the tulsi, enters into their nostrils and transforms them. It transforms their body and their mind. So they're approaching, they're coming, they're going through so many doors, and then they come and they reach the point. And that point is actually a kind of initiation. And so through the course of the several cantos, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, the eighth, the ninth, we're hearing about Krishna's avatars. The avatara, what is avatara? Avatara is one who descends. Ava means down or away. And tara, crossing over. So the Lord is first introducing himself in all these somewhat bizarre forms, really. I mean, the Lord comes as a tortoise, right? I always think, what kind of religion is this that we worship God as a tortoise? And what will people think as soon as they hear that we worship God as a tortoise? What to speak of that we worship God as a boar, a wild pig? Yes, yes, we worship God as a pig. Not just any pig, of course, but a pig who appears. How does he appear? From the nostrils. Nostrils of who? From Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma has how many nostrils? Not just two. He appeared from... Yes, but he didn't appear from all eight of the nostrils. And so on. And of course, Nrsingadev, who will come and solve this whole problem with Jai and Vijay, at least for some time, who is neither an animal nor a human. What is he? Well, he's a kind of combination of both. He's neither man nor lion. It's said like that. He's neither man nor lion. Okay. So what is he? So this brings to us as we go through the Bhagavatam and hear more and more about the Lord, this brings more and more a sense of wonder, a sense that this is some being who is indeed wonderful. This sense of wonder overwhelms Arjuna, to sort of jump out of the Bhagavatam for a moment to Bhagavad Gita. The sense of wonder overwhelms Arjuna, but his sense of wonder is a wonder from a distance. Some people say the high point of the Bhagavad Gita is when the Lord reveals his universal form. This is the dramatic high point. This is the point when Arjuna indeed throws himself at his feet and begs his mercy and begs for pardon. He begs for pardon because he's remembering all the times that he has been with Krishna in an intimate sort of way, sometimes joking with Krishna. And now he's saying, "I'm sorry, Krishna, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. If I knew who you were, I wouldn't have acted like this." So he's in this sense very embarrassed. And in that mood, he is also astonished. He is wondering, and he's so much wondering. He finally asks Krishna at one point, "Who are you? Who are you?" Socrates is famous for having said that the unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined life, asking oneself, "Who am I?" is not worth living. And Hamlet asked a famous question. Hamlet is a character in Shakespeare's famous play, and we probably all know his question, to be or not to be? That is the question. Well, that was his question. That is not the question that we have. We know that there is no question of not being. Is there a question of not being? No. Krishna makes it very clear in his teachings that there's no question of not being. So then it's a question of how to be and how to understand who we are and how to realize that by realizing who is Krishna. And so Arjuna asks, "Who are you?" But what does Krishna answer? He answers, "I am time, and I have come to destroy everyone here." That's not very encouraging. That's not the Krishna we devotees or aspiring devotees want to experience. Although I have to say, on Janmashtami day, I have to speak the truth about myself, that I sometimes look at the clock on Janmashtami because of the fasting. Although I know we're supposed to be so totally absorbed in remembering Krishna that there's no time to eat, as we heard. But I confess, sometimes I look at the clock wondering, when is midnight coming? But that looking at the clock, today we can remember, Krishna says, "I am time." But don't forget the other half of what he says. Kalosmi lokakshaya krit pravidha. Lokakshaya krit. I have come to destroy. And this is the awareness that Kamsa has. This is the awareness Kamsa has. Well, let me read one more verse, one of my favorites. This is just coming also in chapter 2 of Canto 10. The demigods, the devas, are anticipating the Lord's appearance. And as we know, they have appealed to the Lord to appear. They have appealed, they've asked him to appear with the help of Lord Brahma. The demigods cannot actually approach the Lord directly. They need help. Therefore, they go to Lord Brahma and they ask him, can you do something? And so with Lord Brahma, they go to the ocean, the Karanadaka ocean or the Garbhadaka ocean, and they and then Lord Brahma prays. Well, their prayer has been answered and the Lord is about to appear and they're anticipating his coming. So today is also an anticipation, a getting ready. How do you say anticipation in Slovenska? Slovene. Which? Nietzsche Kovan? Pričakovanje. Okay. Today is a day of Pričakovanje. Yeah? Krishna Pričakovanje. Yeah? Something like that.
You were saying correctly, but the use wasn't.
Didn't get the grammar right. Okay, what would it be? Krishne? Krishni? Pričakovanje Krishne. Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Pričakovanje Krishne. Today. Krishne. Pričakovanje Krishne. Okay, we're getting it. I always have to have a little Slovenian language lesson from the devotees because, anyway, it'll be a few lifetimes. So, anticipating Krishna, now we have the demigods, and as is appropriate, they're offering prayers. They're praising Krishna. So here we are, the first prayer I like very much. Satyavratam, Satyaparam, Trisatyam. Satyasya yonim nihitam cha satye. Satyasya satyam, Ritta Satyanetram Satyatmakam Tong Sharanam Prapanna. O Lord, you never deviate from your vow, which is always perfect, because whatever you decide is perfectly correct and cannot be stopped by anyone. Being present in the three phases of cosmic manifestation, creation, maintenance, and annihilation, you are the supreme truth. Indeed, unless one is completely truthful, one cannot achieve your favor, which therefore cannot be achieved by hypocrites. You are the active principle, the real truth in all the ingredients of creation. And therefore, you are known as Antaryami, the inner force. You are equal to everyone, and your instructions apply for everyone for all time. You are the beginning of all truth. Therefore, offering our obeisance, we surrender unto you. Kindly give us protection. This is just one verse, just one prayer, and as Srila Prabhupada once said, one could spend 1 month discussing every single verse of the Bhagavatam, and then he said, do the math, how long would that take to read the whole Bhagavatam? So this is one verse in particular I think one could easily spend a month discussing. Don't worry, we're not going to do that. But the emphasis on satyam, I think it's interesting that the demigods bring this point. We may recall that Parikshit Maharaj, as he is meeting the personified Kali, what is Kali doing? Kali is beating a cow and beating a bull. And by this, he is destroying the three legs of the cow. And what are the three legs? Three legs of Dharma: compassion, austerity, and purity or cleanliness. And one leg is still more or less there. And what is that one leg? It is truthfulness or truth. It's still there in the age of Kali to some extent. At least there is a sense, we have a sense, people in general have a sense that truth is a good thing. What we learn from the Bhagavatam, what we learn from the Vaishnavas, what we learn from our whole tradition is that truth is a person. Truth is the supreme person. Mahatma Gandhi used to like to say, he said, truth is God. Well, his idea was a little impersonal. He didn't say truth is Krishna. He said truth is, God is truth, truth is God. But he didn't say specifically who is that person. So that specific understanding, that specific realization, who is Krishna, who is truth, that we find from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And as a result, what happens, we can, in the process of our practice of Krishna consciousness, we enter into, we are practicing truth, we are becoming part of, we are recovering ourselves as part and parcel of the truth. And that, living in the truth, that is freedom. That is true freedom, to actually live in the truth that is Krishna. So, here also it's mentioning, first of all, Satyavratam, that Krishna himself has a vow, and his vow is to, as we know, as we've heard, as we always hear on this day, paritranaya sadunam vinashaya chaduskritam dharma sangstapanartaya sambhavami yuge yuge. And as we heard, that's not really what Krishna is about. Krishna comes to Vrindavan to open our hearts to intimate relation with him. That's a fact. But he never does anything. All of what he does works together. It all fits together. It's all part of his multi-purpose. And so he promises, he says in Bhagavad Gita, I appear. And when I appear, I have a purpose. And these are my purposes. Purpose number one, purpose number two, purpose number three. It's very systematic. Krishna says, this is what I'm going to do, and then he does it. He kills Kamsa. And he delivers the devotees. And he reestablishes Dharma. How does he reestablish Dharma? In a very wonderful way. Sarva Dharman Parityaja. Forget about Dharma. Mam Ekam Sharanam Raja. And just surrender to me. Just take shelter of me. He gives Dharma by giving what is actually Dharma. And then in Vrindavan, There's no forgetting about Dharma in Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, there's so much Dharma. Because what do we see in Vrindavan? We see Krishna performing his Dharma of caring for his devotees. Starting with the cows. Krishna takes care of the cows. Anyway, so Satyavratam, he's giving his promise, and the demigods recognize he keeps his promise, and because they have that confidence, therefore at the end of their prayers, they're going to reassure Devaki that she has nothing to fear. I think that today is also a day to remember Devaki, the mother of Krishna. The mother of Krishna who could not have her child with her throughout her life. As soon as Krishna appears, as we heard, he is whisked away, and Devaki cannot be the mother of Krishna. That role is taken by Mother Yashoda. But Devaki is also, we should understand, also the mother of Krishna. We heard that Yashoda is actually the mother of Krishna. Yes, and also Devaki is the mother of Krishna. This is what some have called polymorphic monotheism. Sorry. people say, oh, you Hare Krishnas, you are worshipping so many gods. No. We worship one God. We are monotheists. Monotheists? Yes, monotheists. Completely monotheists. There's only one God. Well, come 2 weeks from now, we're going to be speaking about, actually, there are two gods. There's Radha and Krishna, right? Yugalamurti. Actually, we are duotheists. But that's for two weeks from now. Today, we are monotheists. And monotheists, but what sort of monotheism? It's polymorphic monotheism. Right? Yeah. And that's how it should be, because the Lord, getting back to the original point, which is ye yata mang prapadyante tangs tadaiva bhajamyaham, the Lord reciprocates with everyone exactly as we relate with him. He relates exactly as we relate with him. Which means it's very much up to us. How do we want to relate to the Lord? Now you may say, oh well, it's about our eternal rasa with Krishna, and when that's revealed, then we'll know, okay, I'm actually a peacock in Vrindavan or whatever. No, it's today we can make that step. And what is that step of relating with Krishna? It is the obvious. It's through seva. It's through service. It's not just what we think. It's what we do. And that brings us into the truth of Krishna consciousness. Satya vratam satya param trisatyam. Satyasya yonim. Krishna is the yoni, he is the womb of truth. That suggests Krishna is pregnant with the truth, and that pregnancy is to manifest, and that manifestation of the pregnancy of truth, if we keep with this analogy which the demigods are giving, is the Hare Krishna movement, the Krishna consciousness movement that we are all part of. We are unfolding that truth. Just imagine that instead of there being just a few of us here, how many are we? Maybe less than 100. How many people are there in Ljubljana, more or less? 300,000. That's a small suburb of Beijing. A very small suburb of Beijing. Beijing has 100 million people. Imagine that all 300,000 people of Ljubljana would be looking forward to Janmashtami Day. That this day is on the calendar, on the official calendar, the annual calendar. On this day, we celebrate, why Ljubljana, why not Slovenia, right? You've been doing Padayatra around Slovenia. How many years now? 18 years. Yeah, so it's time for the whole of, which is how many people? 3 million, 2 million, something. Two million, okay. So it's time for 2 million people in Slovenia to have officially on their calendar Krishna Janmashtami. What do you think? Yeah, why not? Right? There can be other holy days for different religious traditions. That's okay. But included, there should also be Krishna Janmashtami, and then people will be anticipating, and then you'll have a problem. And the problem is this temple, with its brand new, beautiful floor, which is heated, is going to be too small. So we let us imagine sometimes, huh? Let us imagine such possibility. And then that becomes truth. That becomes reality. So on this day, let us anticipate Krishna's appearance and welcome the Lord as he's appearing. And as I explained a couple of days ago, in the age of Kali, we will not see him face to face. I'm sorry. But we can see him in the heart. And that is more important. Here's the test. Which would you rather? Would you rather see Krishna face to face, but not feel any joy, or maybe instead feeling like Kamsa, fearful? Or would you rather see and feel the presence of Krishna in your heart and feel the joy of Krishna in the heart? Which would you rather? Who's voting for number one? No. Number two? Okay. So that's our anticipation today. So I wish you all a wonderful Janmashtami Titi and Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki. Questions? Yes, dial Nita. Microphone is coming.
Nita Dora Prabhu is asking for further clarification. How it is possible to see Krishna in heart, but
only,
only in the heart, that there are two alternatives, like in the heart and face to face, but not in many other ways, like in the holy name, for example.
How is it possible to see Krishna only in the heart and not in other ways in the holy name? Philosophically, we learn that Krishna is all-pervading. So, philosophically, we practice to see like that. But at the same time, though, we can't realize that philosophy. We don't always see Krishna. Right? So philosophically, we can understand, yes, Krishna is present in the holy name. Krishna is present in all his energies and so on. But we can't really connect. We also have another experience. We have an experience that Krishna is covered and that we cannot see him and that we are looking for him and that we feel distant from him. And when we feel that experience of distance, then we're looking. I was watching the Prabhupada movie and I saw George Harrison, I really want to see you, Lord. I really want to see you. But it takes so long. It takes so long. I'm not seeing you. But when we are not seeing Krishna anywhere outside, besides philosophically seeing Krishna, then we can try and connect in the heart with Krishna by turning to Krishna in the heart. By saying, okay, Krishna, I'm going to give all my energy, my intelligence, my words, my possessions in your service. We can make that commitment in the heart. And when we make that commitment in the heart, then we begin to feel the presence of Krishna. We begin to and slowly we begin to see the presence of Krishna. And then that philosophy of that Krishna is all-pervading comes to life. Then when we're chanting, we're chanting, we're not perceiving Krishna in the holy name. We only philosophically know that the name is non-different from Krishna. But if we would really perceive Krishna, then we would experience the greatest ecstasy. Now, so many times we're chanting our rounds as a duty. So we're not really perceiving Krishna. But as we are making commitment in the heart to give ourselves to Krishna, then he begins to reveal himself.
Well, just to kind of modify I was making something of a false dichotomy. Do you know what that is? What's dichotomy in Slovenian?
Contradiction.
Sort of like a contradiction. Yeah, as a difference, a false difference, inside and outside. Because the Lord is all-pervading, yes, he is outside. Because the Lord is present in his name, he is present in his name. And that is then the form of seeing the Lord in the sound of Krishna's name. But there's a word in English. Here we go. Get ready for this one. Synesthesia. Got you on that one, huh? You know what is synesthesia?
No.
I even got you.
Anesthesia, is it related
anesthesia.
To anesthesia?
Not anesthesia, synesthesia.
it?
It's just the opposite of of anesthesia. Synesthesia is when all the senses are interconnected and you are perceiving sound with your eyes, and you are seeing with your ears, and you are tasting with your sense of touch, and everything is related to everything else of the senses. That's called synesthesia. So, and Krishna is the original, synesthesist. Angani yasya sakalendriya vrittimanti pasyanti panti kalayanti chirang jaganti ananda chinmaya saduchala vikrahasya govindamadi purusham tamaham bhajami. So his angani, his limbs, they function in multiple ways. And what it's saying is, in effect, also, the senses, Krishna's the source of senses. He is the original sensate being, and in relating, connecting with Krishna, the senses, Hrishikena, Hrishikesha Sevanam, Bhaktir, Uchate. Bhakti is said to be the Sevana, the service of Hrishikesha, the Lord of the senses, with the senses. And as the senses are engaged, the external senses, as they become engaged in Krishna's service, then something happens. And that something is we connect with Krishna's senses. And that all brings us to synesthesia. Hare Krishna. Was that clear? Okay, you asked. Now everyone's afraid to ask anything further after that. Any comments, any thoughts, any suggestions, any proposals?
I was just wondering at this point about getting into the scripture and finding out more details about Krishna and his pastimes. So I was remembering reading the 10th canto, and after Krishna killed Dantavakra, he went back to Vrindavan. But it seems to be to me it sounds like a big deal because the residents of Vrindavan missed him so much, but there's not even a chapter dedicated to that. Seems like a big deal. And I read some commentary, but I kind of understand what actually happened when he went. So I was just wondering what happened.
It's your turn.
Right, details. Of course, this you can say is a quite important detail. And I won't be able to go too much into the details of the details, except to say that, as you've pointed out, that is mentioned, that the Lord returns to Vrindavan after killing Dantavakra. And your question is, why is that then not elaborated in the Bhagavatam? One reason is, I think, understandable from some comments from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and that is that the Bhagavatam is very much a summary of not just Krishna's pastimes, but it's a summary of the Puranas in general. I always like to say that, you know, we understand from the Bhagavatam, or we read in the Bhagavatam, of approximately 20 demons that Krishna kills in Vrindavan. 20 or 22, two of them are killed by Baladev, so 20 demons. But on the other side, we understand that Krishna lives in Vrindavan before he leaves Mathura to eventually apparently return. He lives in Vrindavan for 11 years and so many months, according to one of the Acharyas. So, and they also say that Krishna kills at least one demon every day. So starting with Putana, he's a very small baby at the time, and Putana comes, and, you know, we know that story. And then every day, one demon, 365 days times 11, that's a, you know, good number of demons. And all we read about is 20 or 22 of them. So the Bhagavatam is very much a summary of Krishna's pastimes. At this point, unless you stop me, I start speculating. So maybe I should stop. But I do have a speculation also. Do you want to hear the speculation? Everyone loves speculations. Swami speculation. Anyway, the other Swami can correct us after the speculation.
Add another speculation.
Add another speculation. At a certain time of day, especially on Janmashtami, you have to allow for this. And that is that Shukadev Goswami did not want to elaborate on that because it would just put him in too much ecstasy. It would have been, yeah, it would have been too much. He had a job to do. He had to, you know, elaborate Krishna's pastimes, the sort of complete story for Maharaj Parikshit before Maharaj Parikshit leaves. And he has 7 days and seven nights, so the clock is ticking. And if he would then elaborate about Krishna's return to Vrindavan, he could have gotten completely lost in that description, and then could be a problem. Okay, that was my speculation. Hare Krishna.
Mm-hmm. For a speculation, I would definitely file it under speculations. Maybe. Could be.
Yeah.
No, perhaps.
That's what I did give it that introduction.
Haribol, what happened to the professor who read the, if he read the ninth canto of Bhagavatam? He became a devotee or something?
He's asking about the professor who jumped the first nine cantos to read the tenth canto because he read that we shouldn't jump the first nine cantos and he couldn't resist. What happened? Well, he was not hit by a lightning bolt. He's still there. He's very friendly with the devotees. And, yeah, life goes on with him. I don't know if he went back and read more of the Bhagavatam. I should ask him sometime. Yeah. Or I should preach to him. Now you have to go back and read the ninth.
Earlier we were hearing how Krishna appears specifically to attract his devotees, to increase the love, you said, Maharaj, of his devotees. That's the purpose of his pastimes. And I was just wondering about in our movement, how important, then it begs the question, how important is it to hear about Krishna's pastimes? And then obviously the controversial question that comes up so much is how it should properly be done. My perspective being, as a child, you know, growing up in Krishna consciousness, we were hearing about Krishna all the time. Not the amorous pastimes, obviously, but it was like every day, constantly. And it's a big thing, tell your children about Krishna. But when we get older and the move into the temple, it's not so much. It's hardly ever at all, to be honest. Now, I was just wondering how... yeah.
That's a great statement. I really... I almost like to frame it, you know, and hang it on the wall. Yeah, I think so. I mean, Srila Prabhupada very much desired that we would hear about Krishna's direct pastimes. And of course, all are Krishna's pastimes in the greater sense, you know, like Krishna's energies at work, Krishna's... but to speak about Krishna directly is particularly very important to awaken our direct attachment and not only to concern ourselves with Krishna's energies. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada at an early stage wrote the Krishna book and wanted it to be read on a daily basis, and suggested that at night one would read the Krishna book. Devotees should take some milk for the finer brain tissue.
And from protected cows.
and they should read the Krishna book. Excuse me. Yeah. He's a magician. I think he can pull anything out of that day. Now, so, yes, I think we need more of that culture of returning to hearing from Krishna's pastimes. That will benefit us greatly. But at the same time, we extend our vision to also see that now that we have decided to try and dedicate our life to Krishna, that our whole life is also a pastime of Krishna. And within that pastime of Krishna, our life, there's not always time to just sit and hear all day about Krishna. We also have to move the material energy to push Krishna's mission forward and so on. And that is very important. We see that Srila Prabhupada did not spend all his time just absorbing Krishna's pastimes, but he was like working very hard to move the material energy to arrange for the glorification of Krishna, and in that he's ready to talk about building buildings, temples, farms, finance, right? Like all these things. So both are there. Our present life in trying to be a devotee is also a pastime of Krishna. Ladies, questions?
Hare Krishna. Thank you to both for a very nice presentation. Now when Kadambakana Maharaj mentioned this milk, put me back into your lecture, Maharaj, where you were kind of summarizing the this glorification of Krishna as taking care of his devotees, and one of the group or main group of devotees, one of the main groups are cows. So when you came, you said you will be speaking a little bit about bridge preaching, and I wanted to ask you if you can tell something about your own attempt of this bridge preaching, about this book, because as I understand, I'm not familiar with details. People asked you to write a book about cow protection from Vedic perspective, and you yourself as devotees told me avoided that or said that you cannot do it. But then after a while, you decided to do it, and if you can explain why this turn in your decision, and if you can say something about this bridge preaching project, which...
All right. Briefly. I'm writing a book on this subject. The working title, I don't know if it's going to be the actual final title, but the working title is Cow Care in Hindu Animal Ethics, which is not the sort of a title that devotees are accustomed to hear about sort of devotional books, because this is a different sort of a thing. But just briefly, I've been involved since 3 or 4 years now with one little institute in Oxford. It's the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics. And the director of that center was encouraging me to write some book for a particular book series, an academic book series, on Hinduism and animal ethics. And I kind of shrugged my shoulders and said, interesting, maybe not. And then he asked me a second time, and by that time I had found out that there's some other scholar who's already working on a book on more or less that subject. And so I said to him, I said, but you already have such and such who's working on that, so why do you want me to do this book? And his reply was, I want you to do this because you are a practitioner. And as soon as he said that, I thought, uh-oh, that's Krishna. Krishna wants me to do something, because, I mean, in a way, this was kind of like opening a door, the sort of thing that I've been hoping for, why I went back to school, you know, and so on and so forth. And so here it was, you know, invitation. And then I thought, gosh, maybe I should do this. So I started thinking about it. And I thought, well, what is it that we Vaishnavas especially feel is important, and we talk a lot about and we read a lot about, but we don't really have a full picture of, in a sense of kind of getting into all the details of cow protection. So I thought, maybe this is what I should do. So I asked this professor, what if I would do such a book, but my focus would be on this idea of cows, cow protection? And he said, great, go for it. So, but then, after some time, the director of the other center I'm involved with, who's a devotee, the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, he said, why do you publish with that publisher? Why don't you publish with Oxford University Press, which is very prestigious press? And I started thinking, maybe I should try to get that publisher. And then I decided, well, I better call up Garuda Prabhu, Garuda is one of my godbrothers. He's a very senior Vaishnava, and he is actually the first devotee of Bhaktivedanta Institute. Not many devotees know that, but he's been teaching at university for decades, and he has published a few books. So I called him and asked, well, what do you think? Should I publish this or that? And when I explained to them that my book will be, with the present publisher, going into a book series about animal ethics, he said, oh, definitely. This is so much more valuable, more important than even Oxford University Press, which is, you know, that's the top Oxford University. He said, no, no, this is so much better. So in this way, I've been getting a lot of encouragement and from so many devotees, and I've been learning so much on this subject, and I'm praying a lot, especially today, to Gopal Krishna to bless me to get a proper, clear understanding how to present what will be pleasing to the Vaishnavas.